Okay, the plan for today and next week is to go through some aspects of the Megillah in anticipation of Purim. We're already, we have Purim, believe it or not, 2 weeks from today. So it's the Chodesh Adar, so already time to start getting ready. So I wanted to share some brief thoughts, you know, again, unconnected to one another, but some brief insights into some of the storyline in the Megillah. This year, as many of you may know, I happen to be going through Wednesday nights in the shul, in the commentary of Ibn Ezra on the Parshas HaShavua. I'm in an Ibn Ezra mood this particular year. So the Ibn Ezra happens to have a number of very fascinating comments with regard to Megillas Esther. He has two versions of a commentary on Megillas Esther. So a lot of what I want to present today is based on the Ibn Ezra. We'll bring in some other comments along the way that hopefully should be elucidating. One of the questions which is asked regarding Megillas Esther is, why is there no mention of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name anywhere in the Megillah? So some commentaries try to point to an oblique reference to God's name in Perek Dalet, where Mordechai is trying to convince Esther to go before Ahasuerus and to make the case on behalf of the Jewish people. And he says to her, if you're not going to go now, Rezach v'hasala yamod la'yehudim mimakom acher. Salvation will come to the Jewish people mimakom acher, from a different place. Some of the Mefarshim write that the word makom, place, is actually a reference to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we find that in some of the, some of the tefillos which we say. Unfortunately, one of the places it's most familiar to us from is when we make a shiva visit. We say to the person, Hamakom Yinachem Hashem B'Soshar Ve'Lisiyam V'Yushalayim, may the omnipresent, as it's usually translated, console you among the mourners of Zion and Jerusalem. So Hamakom, the omnipresent, is the reference to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who fills up the entire world. We Chazal refer to him as the place. Ibn Ezra writes in his introduction to his commentary to Megillas Esther, that although he thinks that that particular interpretation, that Makom Acher refers to the Ribbono Shel Olam, is nice, he doesn't really think that that's the simple interpretation of the verse. Right, and he gives the following explanation. Says to Ibn Ezra, we only find God referred to as HaMakom, the omnipresent, in rabbinic literature. Chazal refers to God as HaMakom. Tanakh, in the Bible itself, we never find God being referred to as HaMakom in any way whatsoever. So says Ibn Ezra, it's a little anachronistic to look into a pasuk in Tanakh to see God referred to as, to see a reference to HaMakom, and to say, oh, that must be the Ribbono Shel Olam, because years later Chazal used that term in referring to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It doesn't make sense. Okay, so then how do we explain the absence of any reference to God's name in the Megillah itself? So Ibn Ezra writes the following interesting interpretation. We read in Megillas Esther itself how Mordechai wrote down the Purim story, and it was recorded in the Chronicles, the Divrei Hayomu L'Malkei Magai U'Paras. It was recorded in the Chronicles of the Persian kings. Now, says the Ibn Ezra, presumably the way in which it was recorded in the Chronicles of the Persian kings is they took the story that Mordechai wrote down. Nobody likes to paraphrase. Everybody likes to cut and paste. Even back then, when they were using chisels, everybody liked to cut and paste. I mean, it was probably more of a big deal to cut and paste when you're using a chisel and, a hammer. I mean, it makes cutting and pasting a lot more difficult. So nobody was interested in paraphrasing. They just wanted to copy from one place and put it into another. So whatever Mordechai wrote down, they were going to basically copy verbatim into the chronicles of the Persian kings, with one exception. If Mordechai were to mention the Jewish God, the Ribbono Shel Olam, in his version of the event, so when the Persians would copy it down into their chronicles, they would change the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu into the name of whatever God they worshipped. So it would come out that the Purim story in the Chronicles of Persia would be attributed to some foreign god. So Mordechai decided that there's no way that that can take place. But on the other hand, he knew that everything that he was writing down, because it was part of the history of the empire, would be transferred into the chronicles of the Persian kings. So his decision was leave out any reference to HaKadosh Baruch Hu at all. This way, when it gets copied down into the chronicles of Persia, you don't have to worry about it being the miracles attributed to some foreign god or the like. You know, we'll just tell what happened, and everyone can draw their own conclusions as to who's responsible for everything that happened. Right? So it's a fascinating interpretation of Ibn Ezra. You know, we forget about the fact that the events that took place in the Purim story were not simply things that were known to the Jews. They were things that were current events at that time that everybody was talking about in the Persian Empire. And Ibn Ezra goes so far as to say that Mordechai and Esther took special pains to ensure that the story would never be presented in, quote-unquote, the non-Jewish press in such a way that it would even imply in some way that some deity other than the Ribono Shel Olam was responsible for all the events that had taken place at the time. That's Ibn Ezra's, before he even starts explaining the Megillah, that's his Hakdama, his introduction, you know, to getting a sense as to why the most important player in these events, HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, is absent from the pages of the Megillah. Let's move on a little bit through the Megillah. So we know in Perek Aleph, in the first Perek, there's the great feast which was made by Achashverosh, and we know at the height of the feast he invites Vashti to come and appear in front of all of the couriers, all of the ministers who were gathered there, and she refuses to come, and we know the story. So the king calls together his advisors and says, what exactly is one supposed to do with a queen like Vashti? Here you go, you make an invitation, you ask her to come, and chutzpah, you know, she refuses to show up. So in Perek Aleph, Pasuk Tezayin, the Megillah introduces a man by the name of Memucham. The Pasuk says, Vayomer Memucham l'fnei ha-melech ha-asarim. Memucham said before the king and the officers, Lo al ha-melech levado avis la-Vashti ha-malka. Vashti's sin was not simply against the king himself. Ki al-kol ha-asarim v'kol ha-am yashir b'kol medinos v'ha-melech ha-kashveros. Vashti has impacted upon every single marriage in the entire Persian Empire. Women are going to get this crazy idea that if their husband asks them to do something, they don't have to listen. What's going to come next? Hakanzeh. So says Memucham, if it was up to me, he says, there should be a law that will go out. I shall osovo vashti with the Amalek HaKashveros, umalchusto yitzen Amalek Ruhusto atovo mimena. This should be it for Vashti. Get rid of Vashti. Again, although there are those who say that Vashti was simply banished, the more common interpretation is that Vashti was executed. Get rid of Vashti, bring in a replacement, and of course that's the whole series of events, as we know, that leads to the crowning of Esther. So this Memucham actually plays a very, very important role in the storyline. So first of all, who is this Memucham? And second of all, how does he spell his name? How does he spell his name? So there's a fascinating thing. If you look in the text of the Megillah itself, we pronounce his name Memucham as if it was spelled Mem Mem Vav Chaf and a final Nun. If you look in the actual text of the Megillah itself, the name is not spelled that way. The name is spelled Mem Vav Mem Chaf final Nun. So in other words, if you were to read the word the way it appears in the actual text of the Megillah, his name would seem to be pronounced Mumcham, but for some reason we read it Memucham. So who was this gentleman, and what exactly, what, how did he spell his name? Oh, okay. So the most common understanding of who Memucham was, other than just being himself, is that Memucham may have been Haman himself. That's an interpretation which is provided by the Gemara in Megillah. This Memucham is none other than Haman. right? And when Haman is elevated a little bit later on to be the chief advisor to Ahasuerus, he actually underwent a change of name. He used to be Mamucha, now he's Haman, because the truth is that the king, in retrospect, was not so happy with Mamucha. Mamukhan had advised the king to get rid of Vashti, possibly to kill Vashti. The king had acquiesced, but remember, the king had just had 7 days of drinking, and really probably wasn't in much of a position to decide anything, you know, in an intelligent fashion. He woke up the next morning, as the Megillah itself tells us, he says, "Where's Vashti?" "What do you mean, where's Vashti?" Who gave me this this bright idea to get rid of Vashti? Oh, Mamukhan. No, no. Mamukhan's gone. Haman's here now, right? So the change of name from Mamukhan to Haman, you know, may reflect the fact that the king was not so pleased with Mamukhan after the events took place. What's that? You know, I guess, you know, he went away for a little bit, he went on vacation, he came back, the beard got a little bit longer, the hair got a little bit grayer, you know, and I guess somehow he managed to, you know, to disguise his identity in some way. There's a fascinating comment which is made by Rabbi Avigdor Cohen Sedek, one of the Rishonim, whose commentary in the Megillah is printed in this edition Torah Chaim that has many, many annotated commentaries on the Megillah. The Rabbi Avigdor Cohen Sedek assumes that Mamukhan is indeed Haman, like Chazal say in the Gemara in Megillah, and he comments on the unusual spelling of Mamukhan's name. Again, as we pointed out, if you look in the text of the Megillah, Mamukhan's name is spelled as if it should be pronounced Mum-Khan. Now, Mum-Khan, Mum we know is a blemish or something which is absent. Khan, it would be nice to say that Khan means here. The only problem is, you know, Khan meaning here is with an aleph. Right. But Rabbi Avigdor Cohen Sedek suggests the following somewhat homiletic interpretation. And it's fascinating. It helps us understand something that many of us are going to say in shul in 2 weeks on Shabbos Pasha Zocha. Says the Rabbi Avigdor Cohen Sedek, Mum is of course a blemish. Khan, Kaf Nun, the gematria comes out to be 70. Right? Kaf is 20, Nun is 50, 20 and 50 is 70, right? Even on a Sunday morning we can manage to figure that one out. Right? Mum Khan, the blemish, is associated with 70. Oh, so 1 second. So says Rabbi Avigdor Cohen Sedek, if you count up, I invite you to do this on your own time, but if you count up the number of psukim from the time that Haman rises to power in the very beginning of the third chapter of the Megillah until it says that he's hanged on the tree, there are exactly 70 psukim. From Haman's ascent to power to Haman's ascent to the top of the tree is 70 psukim. Says Rabbi Avigdor Cohen Sedek, Mum Khan, the blemish, i.e. the downfall of Haman, is after we've gone through Khan, after we've gone through the number 70. There's 70 psukim of Haman in the Megillah, from his rise to power to his absolute downfall.
I just thought about what we're saying about Haman coming back. It's not uncommon in politics for someone to be banished and all of a sudden you say,
right,
had a new beard.
Right, it was a new persona.
He's now useful to the king for some reason.
Right,
by then he forgot about his life too. So these people, right, the emperor is kind of disposable and if they do, they take
it
back, but they don't.
Right, no, 100%. You know, he came back with a new persona, and the change of name is representative of this new persona. Right, right, right. He used to be a Democrat, now he's a Republican. You know, he's right. Could be the same parallel, you know. Right, no, so number four, people have this ability to recreate themselves, which they sometimes do.
Really come back continually, like even now. Like,
so
if it's not the real person, it's the same person over and over again.
Right. So let's go back to this Rebbe Chaim for a moment, right? Mum Khan Memuchan is Haman, and his very name speaks to the fact that his whole career only spans 70 psukim. The number 70, it would seem on the surface, is incredibly significant, because we know that the number 70 represents the amount of time that elapsed between the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash and the building of the second Beis HaMikdash. In other words, 70 is a period of time that indicates going from destruction to redemption, right? To construction, right? From destruction to construction, from exile to redemption. That's the Vilna Gaon pointed out in a different context. At the very end of davening every day, we didn't say it today because it's Rosh Chodesh, but on a typical day we say, L'matzeach Mizmor L'David, Yancha Hashem B'yom Sara, we read Kapitel Chaf of Tehillim. Says the Vilna Gaon, if you look at that chapter of Tehillim, there are 70 words in that chapter, and Yancha Hashem B'yom Sara, God will answer you on a day of distress. You know, 70 words from beginning to end represents, you know, the 70 years that we go from exile to redemption. So within the story of Purim as well, there's a progression from exile to redemption, and it's associated with the number 70. From the beginning of Haman's career till the, you know, the non-glorious end to his career, it's 70 psukim, you know, in the course of the Megillah. Says Rav Avigdor Cohen Sedek, that explains the line in the Yotzos. Right now, Baruch Hashem, here we are in the Bialystok Shul. We say Yotzos, we said Yotzos yesterday. We say Yotzos on the various Shabbosos, you know, leading up to Pesach. Most of the other shuls here in the Lower East Side do so as well. So if you come to Shul in 2 weeks, the Shabbos Parsha Zohar, and you're early enough, and you read the Yotzros that we say during the Chazaras HaShabbos and Shacharis, the very end of the Yotzros, there's a line, Tachlis Shivim Nisla Al Chamishim. At the end of 70, was hanged on 50. The end of 70 was hanged on 50. Interesting. What on earth does that mean? I don't know. Time to say Kedusha. No, no time to read what it says in the English. Oh, so says Rav Avigdor Cohen said, if you know what it means, at the end of 70 psukim, Haman was hanged on a gallows that was 50 amos high, as described in the pasuk. So tachlis shivim nisla al chamishim, at the end of 70, he was hanged on 50. That's a reference to this idea, you know, encapsulated in the word memuchan. Right, that the Mum Kan, the downfall of Haman, was related to the Kan, to the 70. Right, so even our Yotzes, even the Piyutim and the poems which we say as part of our davening, capture this idea that there's something significant about this, you know, Haman's reign only lasting for 70 years. Now, the identification of Memuchan with Haman, is point out some of the Mefarshim, is incredibly significant from a hashkafic point of view. Because what it means is that Haman was responsible for his own downfall. Consider the following. Who thwarted Haman's plans to destroy the Jewish people? Esther Amalka. How did Esther get into that position of prominence? Well, Haman, i.e. Memuchan, got rid of Vashti so that Esther could come onto the stage. Had Memuchan kept his mouth shut, Vashti would still be queen, and when the time came for Haman to annihilate the Jewish people, Vashti certainly wasn't sticking up for the Jewish people, right? So Haman sowed the seeds for his own destruction. Look at the irony. That's, again, it's not irony, it's, you know, what people out there call irony, we call Yad Hashem, we call Hashkafa, right? But think of the irony of the situation. Who's responsible for getting Esther into power? Haman himself, ultimately. Right? Just one more of the ironies that comes out, you know, through the course of the description of the Megillah. The identification of Memuchan with Haman is made by the Gemara and Megillah, and I think that's the main the most well-known interpretation of who Memuchan is exactly. However, some of the Mefarshim point out there are at least one other approach. There is at least one other approach to identifying who Memuchan is. The Medrash Pirkei de Rebbe Eliezer. The Pirkei de Rebbe Eliezer is the earliest Medrash which we have. The Pirkei de Rebbe Eliezer says Memuchan was actually Daniel. Right? Not that he was, we went from one extreme to the other. He wasn't Haman, not a bad guy. He's Daniel, an extremely beloved individual. The prophet says he was beloved. Daniel Ish Hamudos, he was a beloved person. Daniel was Jewish. We know that he was already a powerful advisor in the Babylonian Empire. We know that he continued to be a powerful force in the Persian Empire. So this Memuchan was actually Daniel. And Daniel was setting the seeds for, you know, what ultimately would be the salvation of the Jewish people. He knew, whether consciously or otherwise, that for Vashti to be out of the picture and for Esther to come into the picture, and he had a sense that perhaps Esther might be Vashti's replacement, would ultimately be something good for the Jewish people. One Jew in a high position in government figured, if we can get other Jews into this position, it's ultimately going to be good and benefit the Jewish people. So, again, you know, that's a very, very different interpretation of who Memuchan is, and gives a certain, a different light as to the understanding of the story.
I see quite one of the questions, but the other thing when we're talking about Yahashem, it's that first interpretation of the Mukhan. It's interesting that in our Yahashem, it's because we see things in layers, but the truth is, Hashem does create the world in a natural way, and people do bring upon their own punishment.
Right.
When they take a Kennedy's curse, it doesn't necessarily mean that that old person cursed them. The way they live in such an entitled way brings upon
these
Daring, stupid things that they do. Right. So, right. But here's with Daniel, I don't see how I can see that it would, but that would be, except from the Ruah, there would be no rational way that he would think that
right.
would come into.
Right. But in other words.
Right.
Right. It may be as simple as that. I mean, again, remember, you know, one of the good things about being a great character in Tanakh is that you actually may have Nevuah. You know, that's one of the perks of being a Daniel. That you know, but even if we say that Daniel didn't know exactly what was going to happen, again, Vashti was definitely not good. You know, so we can only go up from there. And you know, maybe in his mind's eye, he saw that this could go somewhere good. Maybe it wasn't more clearly defined by that, but who knows, you know, maybe this is an opportunity, which as it turns out, you know, was indeed fulfilled. But let's fast forward a little bit. So Vashti is gone. You know, ultimately, as we know, Esther is selected to be the next queen. And once that happens, so we're told in Perek Beis Pasuk Yud, Lo Higida Esther Es Ama Av Yes Moladeta. Esther did not share with anyone the fact that she was Jewish. She didn't speak about, you know, which nation she came from. She didn't speak about, you know, where she had been born. Ki Mordechai Tziva Aleha Asher Lo Sagid. Because Mordechai told her explicitly, don't tell anyone that you're Jewish. Why was it so important to Mordechai to ensure that Esther would not share the fact that she was Jewish? Right? Were they embarrassed of the fact that Esther was Jewish? Why was it so important not to share that information? So, the Mefarshim gives different explanations as to why it was so important for Esther not to share the fact that she was Jewish. We may or may not be familiar with the comment Chazal make in the Gemara and Masechus Megillah, which, you know, certainly is not intuitive, right, but is at least one interpretation of Chazal as to why Esther, you know, would not have shared where she came from. Says the Gemara in Megillah, according to one opinion, Esther didn't share where she came from to make sure that she wouldn't be picked. Mordechai wanted to make sure that Esther would not be picked to be the next queen, so he told her, hide the fact that you're Jewish. I don't get it. So, if she would have been Jewish, she would have been more likely to have been picked. So, explains the Gemara Megillah as follows. We have a tradition that Mordechai was descended from royalty. when it says that Mordechai ultimately goes back to someone by the name of Kish, Kish is actually the father of Saul HaMelech. Saul was Saul ben Kish. So Mordechai was descended from Jewish royalty. He was a descendant of King Saul. And as a result, Esther was descended from royalty. Said Mordechai to Esther, if you breathe anything to the effect that you are descended from royalty, the king is naturally going to want to marry a woman who comes from royal stock. That's especially true given the fact that Chazal say that Ahasuerus was not from royal stock. He sort of married, right, Vashti was from royal stock, but Ahasuerus married into the family and then took over. So, you know, if I get rid of one claim that I have to the throne, you know, it would certainly be something Ahasuerus would be interested in, to marry someone else who could also, you know, buttress his claim to some throne. I mean, again, you know, I don't know to what extent Saul HaMelech really had a claim on the throne of Persia, but okay, but royalty is royalty. You know, even if, you know, you're related to the King of Luxembourg, you know, I mean, it counts for something, I guess. He would want to marry Esther because of her royal lineage. So Mordechai says to Esther, don't mention anything about your royal lineage because we don't want the king to pick you. That's how I'll give this interpretation of the Gemara Megillah. What's that? Right. Again, not, you know, many of these interpretations are not consistent with one another, which is fine, because again, you know, these are different interpretations of different voices within Chazal, different Tanoim, different Amoraim, different Kishonim. So I don't think we have to labor to make everything consistent, but, you know, this is one perspective on the story. The Ibn Ezra quotes this statement from Chazal, and he says there is one opinion in Chazal, but he doesn't assume that that is necessarily the prevalent opinion in Chazal. And he suggests a different interpretation as to why Mordechai would have told Esther, don't mention the fact that you're Jewish. Hanachon ve'enai, says the Ibn Ezra, what seems correct to me is as follows. He also says Mordechai ba'avur shetishmar Torah Hashem v'seisa. Mordechai wanted to make sure that Esther would be able to be as religious as she could while she was going through this process of potentially being selected to be the queen, and that ultimately if she were to be selected as the queen, she would be able to keep up her adherence to Yahadus, you know, even while in the king's palace. What does that mean? Shelo tochal nevelos, the tishra shabosos. Mordechai wanted to make sure that Esther would be able to keep kosher. Mordechai wanted to make sure that Esther would be able to be Shomer Shabbos, below Yargishu HaMishorsa. And she wanted to make sure that no one would really pick up on it. Again, what was the advice? Apparently, Mordechai told Esther, look, you can keep Shabbos and kosher throughout this whole ordeal, as long as you don't wave a flag and make a big deal about it. You know, Persia back then was not the United States in 2017. She was not going to bring a Sabbath observer letter from a rabbi, you know, asking to get out of her Sabbath commitment or, you know, order the vegetarian meal. Right? That wasn't really an option, especially because the whole point of the selection process was for the women to present themselves, you know, in as attractive a manner as possible. And there was a real fear that if she were to go to the people in charge of this beauty contest and say, you know, I only eat kosher, the response would not be, oh, you know, so we'll send to Williamsburg, just tell us which hashgacha you eat. But rather the response would be, we can't have you not eat meat. You know what, you're going to subsist on, you know, on vegetables, you know, for this whole period of time, you'll look pale. We want you to get as much protein as possible. You have to eat the trace of meat. You don't have a choice. But that would only be, said Mordechai to himself, and she makes a big deal about the fact that she's Jewish. If she doesn't say anything, and just, you know, she goes about her own business and doesn't call attention to anything, so then she'll be able to keep up Shabbos and Kashrus, even while she's in the king's palace. if it becomes obvious that she's being Shomer Shabbos and Shomer Kashrus, which again, she said, I'm Jewish, I need to do these things, Shema Amelch Yachlichena O Yahargena, right? The king might force her to violate her, her religious requirements, or he would just kill her. You know, you don't have the right to keep Shabbos and kosher while you're in the palace, and you don't get a second chance. That's it. So the whole idea of not revealing her religion was to enable her to keep her religion. Had she called attention to the fact that she was Jewish, Mordechai was afraid that she wouldn't be able to maintain her frumkeit, while she was under this situation. It's clear that that's the case, says the Ibn Ezra, because to imply that Mordechai somehow might have been embarrassed about the Jewishness of Esther, or to imply that Mordechai would have been less than concerned about the frumkeit of Esther, is simply untenable. Because as he says, Yodanu, ki Mordechai hayo migadola Yisrael. We know that Mordechai was one of the great leaders of the Jewish people at that time. Kihinehu shishi lasarim ha'olim im zrubavda. And here, there's a point which is brought out by the Ibn Ezra, but it's very important, I think, however you're going to look at the Megillah. Mordechai's name is mentioned not only in Megillah Esther. We find Mordechai's name mentioned in the book of Ezra Nehemiah. In the book of Ezra Nehemiah, where it describes how the Jews, right after the Persians had conquered the Babylonian Empire, and Koresh, Cyrus, the king of Persia, had given the Jews free license to go back to Eretz Yisrael and to resettle it. So a bunch of Jews, led by a man by the name of Zerubbabel, went back to Eretz Yisrael. And it lists off who went with Zerubbabel. And in that list, the sixth man in the list is referred to as Mordechai. So our understanding of most of the Mephoshim, is that's the same Mordechai. So Mordechai was one of the, as the Megillah itself tells us, was one of the people who was exiled with Yechoniah. Yechoniah was one of the last kings of Yehuda. There was a group that was exiled 11 years before the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. From that time, Mordechai was exiled and sent to Babel. He was one of the great Jewish leaders at that time. When Koresh gave the green light to allow the Jews to go back to Eretz Yisrael, Mordechai was one of the first people to get on the Nefesh B'Nefesh flight. He said, oh, we're going to Eretz Yisrael, I'm going. And he went. He was the sixth in line, together with Zerubbabel, going back to Eretz Yisrael. So he was clearly an incredible leader of the Jewish people. So that, of course, the timeline of the Megillah story is actually after the Jews have been given permission to go back there to Israel and rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. So that, of course, then begs the question, okay, Mordechai went back to Israel with Zerubbabel, so how do you get back to Persia? Right? So, Aliyah didn't work out, he had to come back home. So right to Ibn Ezra, in a fascinating fashion, he says as follows, Kashira kilo nivna habayis ba el elam v'hoya b'shtar hamelech ba'armon. When Mordechai saw that the Beit HaMikdash was not built immediately, because remember, the Jews went back to Eretz Yisrael, they started building the Beit HaMikdash, they got a lot of slack from a group of people in Eretz Yisrael called the Shomronim, the Samaritans, who are still living in Eretz Yisrael to this day. The Samaritans wrote back to the Persian Empire and said, you can't let these Jews rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, they're a fifth column. And the Persian Empire officially stopped the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. The Beit HaMikdash, from the time that it was started, was not rebuilt until 18 years later. The construction project was stopped for a period of time. Our Masorah is that the events of Purim take place during that intermediate period when the Beit HaMikdash, the construction has been started or has been halted, and it's only after the events of Purim that the second Beit HaMikdash is finally finished. Right, the Megillah is going on while the Beit HaMikdash has all the scaffolding up over it and a lot of signs from the government, saying work in progress, you know, any questions, call this hotline number or something like that. The construction is sort of stopped in the middle. So seeing that things are not going anywhere, says the Ibn Ezra, Mordechai leaves Eretz Yisrael, comes back to Persia, and becomes one of the important individuals who's in the Sha'ar HaMelech, who's in the king's gate. Now, what the Ibn Ezra doesn't spell out is, so why did Mordechai come back? Good, so the Beit HaMikdash is not being rebuilt. So why is that a reason to make Yerida? Why is that a reason to leave Eretz Yisrael and to come back to Persia? Right? So what other Mepharshim spell out, and this may be what the Ibn Ezra means, is that Mordechai came back to engage in political activism in Persia. We see that the Beit HaMikdash is not being built, so, and we see that it's not being built because of interference by the Persian government. So somebody has to give up the dream of living in Eretz Yisrael and come back to Persia to bother the Persian government and make sure that they give us the right to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. And all of the references to Mordechai being in the Sha'ar HaMelech, in the king's gate, says the Ibn Ezra, that has nothing to do with Esther. I think sometimes when we, you know, watch the Purim play, you know, put on by third graders or the like, so our image is, you know, they take off Esther to the palace, and Mordechai, you know, is this, you know, nervous relative, so kind of like, you know, the husband in the hospital, you know, in the old days, you know, when the husband wasn't allowed into the room, you know, so the husband's in the hospital, pacing back and forth, we hope, you know, wondering what's going to happen. So, you know, in a similar way, Mordechai goes to the king's gate, pacing back and forth, you know, trying to figure out what's going to be with Esther. So that's Ibn Ezra. That's clearly not a realistic portrayal of what happened, because you can't just walk into the king's gate, right? I mean, it's probably harder to do that than to get past security at the airport if you're not actually going on the flight. What's that? Well, that was after Esther had already been taken. Right, that's after Esther has been already appointed as queen. But how does Mordechai get to the king's gate? Again, we have this image sometimes in our mind that, well, you know, he was worried, so he kind of hung out by the king's gate. You can't just hang out by the king's gate. What's that? Oh, so it actually fits them together. Hold on. So let's just spell this all out. Give me 1 second, right? So says the Ibn Ezra. So Mordechai was at the king's gate because he was allowed to be at the king's gate. He had a VIP pass. That's what he was doing at the king's gate. Why did he have a VIP pass? Because he was a VIP. Because he was one of the leaders of the Jewish people. So he was allowed access into the king's gate, something that was not allowed to the ordinary person. Now, so he took advantage of that to get as close to Esther as he possibly could, but he wasn't just this, you know, over-anxious relative, let me hang out here and see what I can do, right? He was allowed entry, you know, past the normal security barriers because of who he was, because he set himself up to be someone who would intercede with the government on behalf of the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. That's why he left Eretz Yisrael. That's why he came back to Persia. That's why he had the special access to get into the king's court in a way that other people were not able to get in. And that's why he was where he was when all of the things unfold with Esther. And consider the following. Right? Here's one more idea from the Ibn Ezra that forces us to think about something that, you know, we all know the story of the Megillah, but hey, I never thought of that question. Here's the Ibn Ezra. Fast forward to Perek Gimel for a minute. Right? Mordechai is sitting in the king's gate, and Haman passes through the king's gate every day, and everybody there has to prostrate themselves in front of Haman. And of course, we know Mordechai doesn't bow down, and we know all of the story that follows from that. Esther Ben Ezra, I don't understand. Why does he have to hang out at the king's gate? It doesn't sound like Haman was going around the entire country making everyone bow down to him. You know, it was those people who were present at the king's gate when he walked out of the palace who had to prostrate themselves on the floor. Right? And again, so we know Mordechai, according to Chazal, didn't want to bow down because Haman had some kind of idol on his chest, on his turban, whatever it happened to be. Good. So good. Mordechai's not allowed to bow down to Avodah Zarah. Great. But why do you have to be there to begin with? Just go home. Right, go home. I mean, well, you know, you're making yourself into a sitting target, right? Yeah. And Mordechai's refusal to bow down endangers the entire Jewish people, as we see. Right? So why didn't Mordechai just go home? Why was he hanging out at the king's gate inviting this whole situation? Right? I mean, nobody, good, you're not allowed to bow down to Avodah Zarah, but nobody says you have to put yourself in a situation where you demonstratively don't bow down to Avodah Zarah, and everybody sees that you don't bow down to Avodah Zarah, and as a result, you endanger the entire Jewish people because of your refusal to bow down. Just go home. Why can't you just go home? So it says to Ibn Ezra, obviously, Mordechai couldn't just go home, because Mordechai is hanging out in the king's gate was not just some kind of whim that he had. Yeah, you know, let me hang out here, see how Esther is doing. Mordechai was assigned to the king's gate. He had some kind of official position among the ministers of the king. Right? Again, being in the king's gate was not just a place that, you know, let's go out for coffee, we'll go to the king's gate, you know, it's a nice place to be. No, being in the king's gate was a political assignment. And you can't, if you leave your political assignment, you leave the king's gate, that's the equivalent of going AWOL from the army, and they could court-martial you. You know, ancient Persia, it wasn't like they would just, you know, send you a ticket, and, you know, you have to pay it whenever you get around to it. You know, Mordechai could probably be executed if you left the king's gate. So he has to be there, says the Ibn Ezra. He has to be there. He doesn't have the ability to leave, and therefore he has no choice. You know, when inevitably he's going to be exposed to Haman, he has to refuse to bow down because there really is no way that he could get out of the situation without putting his own life in danger.
I think all these things are true, but I think on the top level of this whole thing,
yeah.
The thought is, I have a really big quirk. This is the first time we're called Eugene.
Right.
And I never call up Jews mm-hmm. or Abraham for anything. I always call it what we are, B'nai Yisrael, or Idri or whatever. This is the first time where it is a very big Gullah story.
Right.
And I'm a childhood survivor, then this reminds me of like someone like my father.
Right.
I see Mordechai as someone, even if he were the top of to anybody, I don't even need that story about about the Zara. I think he won't bow down to anybody, period. I think he's one of these Jews that walk around as a Jew, real Jew, like a Jew boy.
Right.
I don't think he cares what they think. I don't think he's worried about being beheaded. I think he's one of those people that just walk around in his own skin. And I think it's true what you're saying, that even if he was someone in the palace, but the way they start the whole story with his lineage and how they left Bavel, families of survivors, the way they lived through this leaving of Israel, are very more connected and very more protective. And that's why he tells them, don't say that it's the first time we're now in Gullah, like with Yosef, where you have to actually worry about not revealing. Here they lived in the land of Israel, now they're living here. I think the whole thing is, the top part of it is also, even with all that, they're both true at the same time. I think he is hovering, I think he is worrying. You could be tough as a man on the street and still be, this is my baby, I have to...
Right. The question that Vanessa is addressing is, you know, if it's just hovering, who would have let him in? I agree. In other words, is there an element of, you know, he's hanging out there to see what Esther needs? That's a false success. Right? Lazat is Shlomas there, Umayya Yotzeba. You know, clearly his hanging out in the court of the king, in the king's gate, is motivated in part by a hovering desire to know what's going on with Esther. But that which gives him access to what was probably a restricted area indicates that he must have been a VIP. In other words, he was,
When they tell us, well, obviously things were going up, truthfully, it's not nice to say, but we learned. I was working, let's say, you're 5 or 6 or 5 or 6 degrees, you think you're always trying to fix. Then when you get older and you read history, you see things they weren't. But when they say that the ladies of waiting were Jews, a lot of them, I read a whole thing about women in history, and this was like one of the best jobs that Jewish women did have, being couriers and things inside.
Right, inside the palace.
It's proven that they really did. They really were.
Yeah.
And they say that they protect the house. But also, you know, if Mordecai didn't know that family members were recorded, they knew that he was Jewish. So he would have told Esther, don't say you're Jewish, because then they would have been angry that she was Jewish, because Jews are like these horrible people that don't bow down or whatever it is.
Right.
So in our brain, they may not want you in one way, then in other ways, their ideas
to take you in.
You just want to
know that the baby didn't come under the price of the
right. So again, that would support this idea that Ibn Ezra is building that Mordechai is a VIP. Meaning, you know, it's not so simple to just get rid of Mordechai. You know?
Right.
But it may trace itself back to Haman, and that, you know, again, you know, whatever you want to say about Mordechai, from Haman's perspective, Mordechai did command a certain position there in the government and society. It probably wouldn't be so simple to just, you know, knock him off.
Haman has that personality. That's why I said before, Sharpton,
right.
There are certain people that they can be the highest power, and if one Jew does it, they go out of their mind. That's you.
They can't
have
a which is the Megillah itself says, right, about that.
They're not happy with all their power. They want that Jew. They're not normal. Let's face it.
So let me just start the following, and then Basha will pick up. Continuing going through the Megillah, God willing, next week. There's a number of years ago in the shul, we had a speaker from Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Huda Landy, who has put out a beautiful book detailing some of the archaeological studies that have been done about the Persian period and showing how much of the archaeology can shed light on some of the details within the Megillah. It came out a number of years ago for one of the legal holidays here, you know, to speak about some of these discoveries and to show how they shed light, you know, in the Megillah. And one of the things that's, again, very, very striking about, you know, the book, it's a very easy read, you know, big, nice pictures, glossy pictures, you know, if you have good pictures, it's always a good book. But one of the things that's very beautiful about the book is it really shows you, you know, firsthand from the archaeological evidence, you know, how many of the details which are described here sort of derech agav, you know, correlate and can be understood better, you know, based on the archaeological record. I think the name of the book is like something like Purim in the Persian Era. I mean, something, you know, pretty straightforward title, something like that. The author is Rabbi Yehuda Landy. And again, I always take a sneak a peek at it before Purim because it's just, it brings so much of the story to life in a very, very real way. Yeah.
I agree real quick, when we're talking about this, there was a big troll found in Saddam Hussein in the hospital on the phone. And I brought the troll out in the hospital, but it was an official article found. And that's what made me remember that came in to show me what I was involved in. I thought, oh, they're making this up. But then when you see that over and over again, they steal our things and they do these things. These archaeological figures that prove that.
Right.
They do.
Right. 100%. Okay, we'll pick up Hashem next week, 10:15. I think we'll be back downstairs. The davening should be a little bit shorter. Yeah? Okay. Well, that's because the outer door is open. But I'm open to having it upstairs and take a vote, you know. But we'll meet up. We'll meet up, as I said, next week, and we'll give a second shear at different points coming out within the journal.